Welcome to Elite Achievement, a podcast for financial advisors and leaders in financial services who are building and scaling firms. I'm Kristen Burke. Let's start here. There's a difference between being a successful advisor and being an entrepreneur. Most advisors think they want to build a firm, but when it comes to hiring, they run the numbers, they ask themselves if they can afford it, and they wait until it makes sense. In this conversation with Peter Taboris, CEO of Park Avenue Capital, a $4 billion firm within Northwestern Mutual, you'll hear a very different approach. He hires the right person first and then figures out how to pay for it. He makes decisions based on where the business needs to be a few years from now, not where it is today. And you can hear how clear he is on where he's going. This conversation gives you insight into the way Pete thinks, the decisions he makes, and the level of risk he's willing to take. Pete, I'm looking forward to today's conversation. I've been talking with more and more advisors who either have a vision to build a firm or they find themselves heading in that direction as they start hiring and building a team. And at some point, they realize they have to start thinking and operating more like a CEO. So for listeners who may not be familiar with Park Avenue Capital, can you give us a quick overview of the firm today?
But very nice to be with you. Thanks so much for the invitation to have this conversation. So Park Avenue Capital today is about $4.3 billion in assets under management. We have employees across 14 states, I think in total approaching 60 employees. We have three partners, myself, Ben Feldman, and Dan McCoy. Ben is a Northwestern Mutual legend, fellow producer, and Dan McCoy is an operational assassin who is our president and basically runs the day-to-day. Park Avenue Capital is very much a planning first organization and has created a value proposition that I think differentiates in the market in that respect. And the future is bright. I think in the next 5 years, we could very easily double our size and are really excited about the opportunity.
Well, I know you were a very successful producer before you built Park Avenue Capital. So at what point, Pete, did you realize you were no longer just building a successful practice, but actually building a firm?
Yeah, about 3 years ago, my partner and I, we were both operating as individual advisors, and we decided to merge, recognizing the opportunity in the wealth management space, the tailwinds, including, you know, the transition of wealth from the baby boomers to the next generation, to the half of our industry retiring in the next 10 years. And so, you know, recognize that there's probably a pretty good opportunity to merge our resources and grow organically, but sensibly through mergers and acquisitions. And so, but I would say, so at that moment, really, when we came together, we each brought in teams of, you know, I had seven or eight people, he had seven or eight people, and very much operating like a lone wolf or, you know, just a solo advisor. I would say today, having approaching 60 employees, the moment I really realized that this was a firm and not a personal practice was when we had started to hire a manager layer between us and the firm, like real non-producing managers and high quality non-producing managers. And now, you know, the organization very many ways feels like a well-oiled machine, and all that credit goes to key players like Dan McCoy, Chris Bremer, and Zach Oster. And you know, at this stage, like I'm just really in charge of bringing in new business, big picture strategic thinking, like dreaming, and they're really in charge of, you know, developing people, creating systems, workflows, all things that if I was doing them, I'd be doing C minus D plus work. You know, that's not what interests me. That's not what is best for the firm. Like I'm best in more a client service role and thinking big. And so, you know, we really leveled up once that management layer, we implemented that management layer. And, you know, I don't even interview prospective employees anymore, which is really a liberating and gratifying feeling when the first time you meet somebody is, you know, at your quarterly offsite. But you've essentially hired them, but you've never met them. So, you know, I think it's really been awesome.
Let's talk more about the management layer. I'm sure that was not an easy investment for you to make in the firm at that time. I'm sure that came with some expense. Like, how did you and Ben think through making that decision? And how did you feel comfortable investing in the professional management that the firm needed?
Yeah, I mean, I think my approach has always been, and this is before Ben and I merged, my approach has always been to never make an infrastructure or personnel decision, never ask myself today, ask myself 3 years from today. Because myself today wants a nicer car, wants a nicer house, you know, wants the instant gratification of, you know, the success that I'm experiencing. And myself 3 years from today would say, you don't want the watch, you don't want the car, you want to make this investment. And it, because myself 3 years from today, at the rate that we're growing, you know, it's much better for me to be long-term greedy and not short-term greedy. To give you a sense for that, when I first hired our CIO, Chris Bremer, in 2018, my advisory assets under management were about $85 million. And today, you know, over seven years later, we're, as a firm, $4.4 billion. So any decision that I was making along the way that kind of was long-term greedy, not short-term greedy, has contributed to the growth that I've experienced over the last 7 to 8 years. So I've always operated with that philosophy. And I don't think that all advisors are entrepreneurs. And I think as an entrepreneur, entrepreneurs are willing to operate pretty close to the line. And what I mean by that is, you know, make the personnel investment and figure it out. Like, you know, I've never thought about personnel as a cost. I've always thought about it as an investment. And I think most advisors that are not entrepreneurs are thinking about the cost and would rather not hire that person and keep their income the same versus hire that person and take a pay cut. So I think true entrepreneurs are being opportunistic first and then figuring it out after. So, and there's risk in that, and you operate close to the line. And honestly, like in the 25 years I've been doing this, this is the first time in my career that I've really felt any sense of financial security.
Interesting. Cause I think people probably assume you would have felt it earlier with the success that you've achieved.
No, I mean, you know, I mean, if you think about, you know, even our, I mean, today, much different than it was, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago. But, you know, I've always operated at well over the expense cost ratio for staffing than, you know, the industry benchmarks would ever suggest, just because I've always kind of doubled down and bet on myself. So, yeah, I mean, and I heard Andy Schwartz say this once when I was young in the business, that he really didn't ever feel like he ever made any money until he was like 25 years in the business. And ironically, the same thing, I experienced the same thing in my career. I've never felt comfortable, or I hadn't to this point felt comfortable, because I was always, you know, relentlessly pursuing this vision that magically materialized, you know, 25 years later. And in that process, you know, there's risk that's associated with that. And there are people that are willing to take that risk, and there are people that aren't. So
if an advisor is listening and they know they need to make this investment in personnel to grow their firm, but they don't have the risk tolerance to do it, or they don't have the courage to do it, what advice would you give them?
I mean, you know, I think there's a mismatch in expectations versus reality there. I mean, at the end of the day, like, if you want to be, I mean, if you really want to boil it down to, like, if you want to be me, you have to be oriented to take risk. If you're not oriented in that way, you're just not ever going to grow at the trajectory that I've grown at. And that's simply because, you have to be willing to operate outside of a comfortable place. Now, you know, it's not easy. And I don't think I ever operated so close to the line that I ever put, like, myself or my family in, like, a compromised position. But definitely, like, you know, there were periods where I might have had a light insurance production month and worried about paying my payroll, or where it was coming from, or, you know, selling investments to make, you know, to pay my payroll. And so, you know, I lived in that kind of mindset because I was always a, you know, hire the right person first, mentality. I operated in that mindset for many, many years. So.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate you sharing that so candidly, because I think people will look at what you built, but don't realize some of the emotion that goes into what you built, or some of the difficult decisions, some of the risk that goes into what you built.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's been, I modeled some of that. My dad was an entrepreneur and a risk taker. And, you know, I think, like, I think, you know, I've always thought in this business, like, and I'm very much a Nick Murray disciple. You know, there are two activities in this business, two possible activities in this business. There's prospecting and there's avoiding prospecting. And, you know, from my perspective, like, if you have that mentality and you're very uncomfortable avoiding prospecting, because, you know, if you're avoiding prospecting, you're ripe and rotting, you're not green and growing. The business that's where you start to get into trouble. You know, I always knew that as long as I was relentlessly prospecting and stayed out of the avoiding prospecting side of the page, that my success was assured, because, you know, to the extent that I was willing to make the approach and hear the word no from potential prospects, I was going to get a yes at some point. And my ratio of no's and yeses to no's got better and better over time. And so as long as I was willing to make the right number of approaches, I was essentially assured to be successful. And so, you know, that having that in the back of my mind and anchoring to that gave me the comfort to take that risk. So.
Yeah. I find that a lot of advisors are quick to move away from the fundamentals. And one of the challenges that I'm seeing as advisors are building firms is they're in what I call the messy middle. They're still the main one driving revenue. So there's that need to prospect, meet with clients, but they're starting to layer on leadership responsibilities. So there's almost this push and pull of their time. Yeah. Do you remember going through that when, you know, this was even probably before you merged with Ben?
Yeah. I mean, I've never really, like, ever viewed myself. I've never really taken myself too seriously, honestly. And, I was just an effective producer for many years who was strategic and had, you know, a big vision, but I'm not great at developing employees. I don't enjoy, like, leadership meetings with people. I did some, like, you know, operations mapping and process related stuff, but it all made me very uncomfortable, because at the end of the day, even, you know, if I'm doing anything other than prospecting, I'm out of the business. I'm gonna fail. And I think, you know, I remember when I was very young in the business, like, my mom, having to call my mom and being like, I don't know, my rent was like $1,500 living in New York City. And I'm like, I don't think I can make rent this month. And she sent me a check for like $500 to like make my rent. And I think like to a certain degree, like I still live with the fear or the nightmare that like I'm gonna not be able to make my rent. Like that's no matter how much money I'll make, that feeling still exists in my core. And I suppose I'll never feel totally secure, which, you know, ultimately is a scary thought, because I'm going to be relentlessly working, you know, or pursuing this vision. And in that sense, like, as I'm saying it out loud, like the sky's the limit, you know, like 5 years ago, I would have never thought we could be at 4.3 billion, you know, and, you know, I guess our 10-year goal is to be at 25 billion. Like, what if that's 50, you know?
You are very driven by vision. We've talked about it, Pete, a couple of times. Have you always been visionary, or did you sit down one day with a notebook and write this big vision for Park Avenue Capital? Like, how does the vision come about for you?
Yeah, I mean, we had a vision in training in August of 2002 that I scribbled on a piece of notebook paper that I still have at my desk at home. And like, even looking back on that today, it's pretty wild to like, you know, see the mindset of a 22-year-old and like what your definition of being great would be. So I've always been acclimated in that way. And visiting it for years, I used to wake up in the morning and read my vision and then go to bed at night and read my vision. And the funny thing about vision is if you're like relentlessly focused on it, you naturally do what's necessary in the pursuit of it. So like, if I was really relentlessly focused on my vision, you know, I didn't really have to think about doing 300 phone calls when I first started in this business. It was second nature to me. Like, I just did it because I was forcing myself to do it. I did it because, you know, my vision, I was anchored to my vision, and that's what I'm focused on. And like, if my goal was to make 250 calls and it was 3 o'clock, like, all right, I'm just going to make another 100 calls, like, to fill up the day, you know? So I've just always been very focused on, vision, and it gives me it's gratifying to be thinking about the future and the unlimited possibilities and problem solving around how to get there. So I guess that's what really is fun for me, in general. It just so happens I'm in this business. I mean, I suppose if I was in another business, I'd be, you know, maybe successful in a different way, because I still be acclimated towards problem solving and vision building. And so.
Well, and you had mentioned that now you get to spend more time visioning in the business. And of course, probably hasn't always been that way. I'm sure there were a lot of times, you know, as you were building your practice, once you merged with Ben, as you guys created Park Avenue Capital, how has your work and how you spend your time shifted, Pete, as you've gone from being a producer to now a CEO?
Yeah, I mean, really, it has been, it has been incredible, because I've gone from, you know, as a solo producer doing everything, to then hiring some people over time to doing some of everything. And then once we started to hire management, et cetera, I've now really gotten back to and focused on the things that I am best at, which are prospecting, being at the point of sale and closing business, being with our existing clients, dreaming big. And I've always kind of thought about my time, you know, like I couldn't afford to hire myself. But I can, if I can give myself capacity or find capacity for myself, I essentially can hire more of myself. So imagine if 50% of my day is spent with clients and 50% of my day is spent with like operations, paperwork, you know, investment analysis, what have you. I could hire someone for $250,000, a high quality person, to do all of those things. And if I hire someone for $250,000 to do those things, I've essentially given myself the capacity to another 50% capacity. And so I've always thought in the terms like, well, I can hire myself for $250,000. That to me represents great arbitrage, right? I can't hire myself. I couldn't pay myself. I couldn't afford to pay myself to do what I do. But capacity gives me the opportunity to create arbitrage in my time. I can hire somebody else to do this work for much less, which unlocks capacity for me to do much more. And so I've always thought about my time as an opportunity cost. And I think many advisors are probably programmed, or if you're not an entrepreneur and you're an advisor, you're looking at, you know, hiring someone to do that stuff as a cost. And I never thought about that. I thought it was, from my perspective, way more expensive for me to be dedicating my time to stuff that wasn't moving the ball forward. So.
Yeah, we're back to that shift of, are you operating like an entrepreneur? Or are you operating like an advisor?
Right. And it's okay. I mean, you know, you can have a great career in this business being an advisor, not an entrepreneur. But I think you have to, you know, you have to recognize up front that that's, or I think it's something that you have to like have an awareness to. And you know, if you're not an entrepreneur and you're more an advisor, maybe you partner with somebody who's got more of the characteristics of an entrepreneur and kind of leverage off of your strengths in that way.
Sure. Well, a lot of what we're talking about here with unlocking your capacity and freeing up your time assumes you'll actually delegate work to the people that you hire. I know a lot of advisors struggle to delegate, and they especially struggle to delegate other people meeting with clients on the team. How did you navigate that?
First is you have to hire high quality people, and you start with trusting them, and you give them the autonomy and the freedom to do their job and to break things and to rebuild things. So it takes a very high degree of trust. But that was something that was very natural for me. I'm a trusting person to begin with, and I'm acclimated to not waste time and be only focused on the things that I'm good at. So I was never micromanaging people. I was giving them vision, strategic direction, weighing in on significant decisions, and then just letting them do their job and not getting in the way. Like that's the, I think one of the things that is common in our business is that advisors that just cannot get out of the way. You just have to get out of the way and let high quality people do what they do. I'm eager to get out of the way and just let people trust them and give them direction, but let them do what they do. And you know, I think that makes it like, I would guess that the people that, you know, work with me would say that, you know, I have high expectations, but I'm not micromanaging them and I'm letting them do what they do. And as long as the job's done well, like, you know, they have a lot of autonomy, And I think that's empowering and makes this a pleasant place to work. And like, we're all about attracting like the top talent in the industry. So yeah, I would just say like to any advisor, like look yourself in the mirror and ask yourself, you're getting in the way. If you're getting in the way, you know, it's long-term. That's not going to be accretive to your business value.
Was there ever a time you found yourself getting in the way of the vision you wanted to build or the firm you wanted to build?
Not really. I mean, I think like that's my, if I were to like rank, you know, a superpower I might have, like, I think that's one, I think part of it comes from the fact that like, because I'm so opportunistic in the hiring process, and I'm hiring for the right person first and figuring how to pay for it later. I think when you're willing to pay at the top of the market for the best talent, you're starting ahead of most people. Most advisors are, you know, not inclined to pay the top, you know, to pay the top of the market for the top talent for a position. I guess just the byproduct of my philosophy is that we just get really good people where I can start with trust and give them direction, and, you know, it just works out.
Yeah. How do you figure out, Pete, who the right people are to hire? So how do you figure out kind of what the firm needs and what that next hire is?
Yeah, I mean, well, the good news is for me, I don't really do much of the hiring anymore. Now, in terms of ELT leadership positions, yes, of course, I'm involved. I think, you know, non-negotiable are core values that we have to be aligned in that respect. And yeah, I mean, how else would I? I think people that have a focus on, you know, family and you know, have clear priorities, like a work-life balance and priorities and a work-life balance, I think that's really important. I think like folks that are inclined to make the right decision, not necessarily like early on the most profitable decision. Ironically, like the right decision is always the most profitable decision long term, but in the short run, it might not feel like that. But yeah, I think probably like table stakes really are values alignment and just never compromising in that way. So,
yeah, I once heard that if values aligned, there is no problem that cannot be solved.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. You know, I think we have core values that you know, we're revisiting every quarter in our team offsite, and you know, if you anchor to those and stay true to them, you know, any personnel decision, really, in any of the personnel decisions that we've made in terms of letting people go, the question's always asked, like, is this particular employee aligned with the core values? And if the answer is no, or if their actions were not aligned with the core values and the answer is no, that the debate is kind of over. You know, if you really are using your core values as your North Star, it really cuts down on like the waffling that can go on with like, how do we deal with this situation? It's, you know, at the end of the day, if those actions or that employee, if they were not consistent with the core values, like they got to go. That's it. And I've learned a lot from our president, Dan McCoy, who's got a lot of experience in leadership. And not that that wasn't something that I would have inherently done in the past in terms of, but he articulates these things so well. And I've really learned a ton, and in terms of, my own leadership development, working with him. So really thankful to work with him.
Yeah. Well, and as you're thinking about your own leadership development, Pete, have there been other resources that you've leaned on, books or mentors? Like, who has really helped you, you know, step into the role of the CEO?
Yeah, I mean, so Dan, of course, I worked with John Wright Sr., who's a Northwestern Mutual legend, for 10 plus years. He was a great influence on me. I think there were elements of my father's leadership style that were great, and there are elements of that weren't so great. I think, you know, hopefully modeled after the great parts of his leadership. I'd say, you know, my, in some certain respects, like, and not so much, I think my wife to a certain degree, like just in the way that she leads our family, like I've taken a lot from the way that she interacts and deals with people, and our kids. And, I'd say my partner, Ben, for sure. He's a very different approach. I think like our employees, look at us as like, I'm the strict dad, he's the fun dad, you know? So, I can be kind of at times, especially in like stressful situations, like pretty like direct and demanding. And Ben has been a great influence to me on kind of taking some of the edge off of that. There's a collection. I've surrounded myself with a lot of people that I feel fortunate to have been able to like observe and take, you know, something from all of them. So.
Great. Well, we've talked a little bit about the vision for the future. And did you say that the vision is 25 billion, but maybe it could be even bigger?
Yes. Yeah. 25 billion is we call it a BHAG. 25 billion is a BHAG in 10 years. I think that's a 5X or more from where we are today. How do we get there? I mean, I don't know. We're working on some pretty fun stuff right now that I think, you know, you can, yeah, it was a goal without really a real plan behind it. Like, you know, certain things had to be true in order for that objective to occur, but those things are starting to materialize. Then you're like, well, it's 25 billion too little. But I think it's big enough for us at this point. 5X in 10 years would be pretty outstanding. I'm excited. I wake up every day, ready to go, like ready, you know, to, I feel like, there's an image that I have in my office of a great white shark. And there's a quote that's talking about, you know, do sharks, you know, what do sharks do on a Monday? They're like out in the ocean, like chasing stuff around, biting stuff. Like that's my mentality. Like I'm pretty charged up every day. Most of my work gets done, you know, between 5 a.m. and 11 a.m. I've got the most energy and I'm the most, and I'm not as accessible early in the morning. I can get a lot more done. So, but I wake up every day pretty charged up because I'm excited about what we're doing. So
I love that image of a shark. You're right. A shark is not thinking, well, it's Monday and I don't know if I really feel like attacking today.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I'm always in that kind of attack mode.
Well, as you are preparing to attack this BHAG, this big, hairy, audacious goal, how do you, Pete, think you need to grow or change as a leader to 5X where you are today?
That's a good question. I think like one of the things that I'm, and I've gotten better at this, but one of my weaknesses is, and this is just a personality, like if I, you know, any personality test that I've ever taken has always pointed out that I'm direct to a fault. I'm empathetic, But when I'm in a business situation, I kind of put, I prioritize getting the task done versus, and put empathy on the side. And I'm so oriented on like getting the task done and not being empathetic. And when you operate like that, people can feel like you're insensitive or you don't care, or, you know, and that's not true at all. Actually, I do care and I'm sensitive, but I just am so task oriented that I can sometimes get lost in the empathy gets lost. And so I think, you know, just having an awareness, to that, I think, will make me a better leader as in pursuit of that goal, because I think I can be misunderstood in the way that I, in the way just that I am. And, you know, it's just part of my personality, and I have to just have an awareness to it and, really stay focused on, you know, the person in front of me, not just the task behind them, you know? So.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. And it takes me back to a time when my firm was using the Culture Index assessment. Yeah. And I am very high B, high yellow, very social. And my leader I was working with was low B and social. And I thought for the longest time he didn't like me. And then once right. I understood the Culture Index, I thought, oh, I think out loud, he processes internally. I'm more social, I want to chit chat, he wants to get down to business. Right. And that awareness, I think, really helped with the relationship.
Right. I mean, yeah, I don't know what my classification is, but I think you probably know what my classification is. And it is super effect. I think my classification, like, you know, if you want to be, you want to be behind someone who's so like my personality is one that, like, you know, I'm really geared to get stuff done and manage a lot of different balls in the air. And, so I think, like, you certainly, I think, like, I'd be somebody that you maybe want, you maybe bet on to do tasks, do it quickly and do it well. But whoever's in the way can sometimes just feel a little, you know, like, I'm not seeing them. And I think that that's definitely something that I've got to work on and stay present with, you know. So.
And that skill, I'm sure, helps you as an advisor when you continue to sit down and meet with your clients.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, it's funny. It's like in that conversation with someone, I think, like, for some reason, because I see so many of my, I'm a naturally curious person, and I operate from starting point of like interest and care in just being an advisor. It's a different, I don't know, maybe is it possible to have a personality test, like a different result for a different role? So like my role as a CEO, could I have a different score or different test result than my role as an advisor? I think for me, I probably have a dual personality. not in a disingenuous way, like just in a, you know, it is like my orientation as a business owner, entrepreneur is much different than my orientation as an advisor, I think. Yeah. So I probably need more of my advisor self to come out in my business self, you know, so.
That's an awesome insight. And I think that really, Pete, sums up a lot of what we have been talking about on this journey that advisors go through as they go from being a producer, having a practice, to starting to build a team, to now building a firm, to now being a CEO. I think there are skill sets that they start to transfer over, but there are also differences in the role.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. You said that well.
Well, Pete, this has been a fantastic conversation, and I greatly appreciate you taking the time to share with us more about your journey and your career and what you have built at Park Avenue Capital. So if our listeners want to learn more about you or the work that you are doing, where can they go?
You can visit pac.nm.com is our website. Feel free to drop me a line if you want to connect, or on social networks like Instagram or Facebook. So.
Yeah, great. And to those of you listening, what are you taking away from today's conversation? I appreciate you listening and investing the time to grow as a leader. Follow Elite Achievement for more conversations on leadership and building a firm.